Welcome to the Midday for a Thursday. I'm Norman Gilliland in our Buck studio once again, and Christopher Taylor has returned. He's at the piano. He'll be performing with the Madison Symphony this weekend, and a program that is actually an unusually designed program. We'll get into that in a second. Welcome back, Christopher.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Pleasure having you here again. Going to be very different from the ragtime program you played couple of weeks ago on this show. The Madison Symphony concerts Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon are going to have the Bruckner, did you say it was the 7th? Bruckner Symphony.
Yeah.
Which is a big work. And then somewhat unconventionally in the first half, it's going to be you. Two keyboard concertos, let's say.
Correct, yes.
One by Bach and one by Liszt, so very different ones at that. And the trick with the Bach concerto seems to be is what instrument did he actually write them for originally, because they exist in various forms or partial forms.
That's
even
right.
In his own time.
That's right. Yeah, Bach was never averse to cannibalizing his previous works for other purposes. So I guess there's evidence that the concerto I'm playing for this set of concerts, the A major concerto, started life as a concerto for oboe d'amore. And but that version has actually been lost, and all that survives is his rearrangement of it as a keyboard concerto. It's certainly a little hard for me to imagine exactly what it was like on the oboe, but
really?
Apparently someone has, in fact, attempted to reconstruct it and perform it, but I haven't actually heard that.
So why do you think it would is so hard to imagine as an oboe d'amore concerto?
Well, it seems very keyboardistic to me, but I guess that's just because that's what I'm used to. And
take up the oboe d'amore and give us some insights next time you come back.
another year's time, maybe I'll have figured that out. Of course, as a pianist, I take some comfort in this idea that Bach was flexible regarding instrumentation, since I'm, in fact, playing the piece on an instrument that essentially didn't exist in Bach's lifetime.
But we know that Bach, like Beethoven after him, and probably a number of composers, was interested in the latest instrument, and the keyboard was something that was changing rapidly, even in the early 18th century during Bach's time.
Oh, yes. In fact, the first piano was built around 1700, so Bach was, only 15 at the time. And yet the new instrument didn't really spread and gain popularity for quite a while, and apparently Bach did try a couple of pianos late in his life, and the first couple he played, I guess, were fairly inferior instruments, and he was a little dismissive of them. But he did play, I guess, a third time on the instrument, and it was a better one, and he was impressed that it had potential.
And when we say piano, we mean an instrument unlike the harpsichord that can play loud or soft piano, e forte.
That's right. Now, that's where the name pianoforte comes from, soft and loud in Italian. Shortened to piano, which just means soft, which is a little bit of a misnomer.
It could just
perhaps
as easily be called it the forte.
Yeah, could have been the loud.
Okay, about this concerto then, what are some of the things that we find in it?
Well, it has the traditional layout of a concerto, kind of in the Italian style, which is the model for essentially all of Bach's keyboard concertos. So three movements, fast, slow, fast. And the form centering around this alternation between the full group and then a smaller ensemble. So just sort of loud, soft, loud, soft. And the loud part where everyone plays is generally the same theme that keeps coming back in different keys. And at the end, it finally comes back in the home key. And that's the end of the movement.
Do you have a sense, Christopher, of what the context would be for actually performing this concerto in Bach's time? Because, he wrote, so much church music. He didn't write operas. He didn't write for the theater. He was really essentially a church composer. Would there be a place for a concerto in a church service, or where would this have been played?
That's conceivable, but it was probably more frequently a secular sort of setting.
He did like the coffee houses, so it's possible.
Right, right. Well, and sort of, maybe it's anachronistic to use the word salon, but in any event, in sort of a gathering of aristocratic or upper middle class music lovers, everyone would grab an instrument and there'd be someone who'd be the keyboardist and then a bunch of string players and off they'd go.
That's true, just for private entertainment.
Basically, yeah.
Well, play us some. And what about it? What do you have there?
Okay,
fingers?
I can play you the recurring theme, the theme that's played by the whole orchestra from the first movement. And what's interesting about this is that the interaction between the piano or the keyboard and the orchestra, sometimes they're in unison. My right hand and the first violins are doing exactly the same thing, and my left hand is doing exactly what the cellos and basses are doing.
Oh, so you're kind of a miniature orchestra on your own.
Kind of. And yet, sometimes I'm doing stuff that's more soloistic, that stands out against the crowd, and other times I'm doing stuff that's accompanimental. So, in fact, at the very beginning, the violins are playing kind of the theme, which is I never get to play those notes, so I'm playing just sort of accompanying arpeggios to go with that theme.
When you mentioned the orchestra,
yes,
this is the Madison Symphony in this case. Is it going to be part of the orchestra playing in the tradition of the smaller orchestra?
That's
box
right.
Time?
Yeah, it'll be a smaller group of string players, and there are no winds in any of these keyboard concertos. And then it'll actually alternate between within that small group. There will then be a subset who plays during the quiet parts. The term that they use are ripieno for the full group and concertino for the
little subgroup. And the old concerto grosso layout.
That's right. That's how it works. So this is ripieno stuff. So after a couple of measures of my doing sort of arpeggios that are accompanimental, then I start playing the tune. So, of course, it's a little awkward doing this without the ensemble, but you can still get a bit of an impression of
what
it's going to be like. First of the little concertino sections, where it's where I'm highlighted as a soloist, and the number of string players reduces down.
I know it's wonderful. I mean, these Bach concertos are really they come across almost as like little jam sessions. There's just something about it where everybody's sort of doing their thing at one time or another. Almost sounds improvised, but of course it's extremely structured and thought through. Yeah. And the minute you started playing, I thought that could be nobody but Bach.
Right.
It's so distinctive.
Yeah, I mean, it's very bustling and active and merry, joyful music and
full of counterpoint voices going in different directions.
I mean, the two different hands each doing interesting dance-like things. Always lyrical and tuneful, and it's a wonderful combination of the the intellect and the and
the emotions,
genuine heartfelt sentiment.
So in the first movement, do we have what kind of resolution for these themes?
Well, I mean, they don't exactly develop in the manner of classical and later period themes. They're sort of just juxtaposed in a way. But he definitely takes little pieces of that theme and he extends them and elaborates on them during the concertino sections. And then, as I said, the ripieno, the full group, keeps coming back, basically with that same material over and over again, usually shortened and often in different keys. So the second time it comes back, instead of being in A major the way it was first go round, it's in E major. And then a little later, it comes back in the minor, and that changes the character of it a little bit. And when you hear, the F sharp minor version or something. And then you heard at the end of that, I again go back into soloist mode. And so you can sort of hear that alternation even without the orchestra behind me and without necessarily knowing the piece. It's a different sort of character back and forth.
So these concertos in Bach's time, when we're talking 1720, 1730 or so, do they have the cadenza yet? Is that part of the concerto at this point, that it's usually at the end of the first movement where the soloist gets to go a little crazy?
Right. It was just beginning to appear. It doesn't really show up in this concerto, but in the first keyboard concerto, the D minor, there's a fairly extended period at the end of the first movement when the keyboard player is all by him or herself and really goes wild. It's it's fantastic, but it's not like the classical cadenza, which was improvised and which was basically, I mean, in some ways, a less elevated sort of thing. It started off as just an elaboration of a cadence. That's what the cadenza originally was, and then eventually, they started adding. just trivial sort of scales and arpeggios, and then always ending with the trill. So that was the cadenza in its heyday in Mozart's time. And then gradually composers wanted to reassert control and they started writing out their cadenzas and they became more elaborate. And then in other cases, they just ditched the idea completely. And
I'm suspecting not with the case of Franz Liszt, and we're going to look into Liszt's first piano concerto, more with pianist Christopher Taylor, live from our Buck studio. When the midday returns, right after this, here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Back with Christopher Taylor. He's playing the Liszt and the Bach piano concertos, or not their one and only, but concertos by those two composers with the Madison Symphony this weekend, three concerts, Friday, Saturday night, and then Sunday afternoon. And we got on this topic of the cadenza, which was just starting to come in as Bach was writing concertos in the 1720s and 30s. By the time we get to Franz Liszt, I'm guessing full-blown romantic theatrical concert hall playing,
right,
that there's some pretty flashy stuff. Did Liszt write out his cadenza for the first piano concerto?
Well, yes. He notated everything that he wanted the pianist to play, and there was no longer any option of improvising. It's not a cadenza. I mean, the first concerto does not have a cadenza in the traditional four-fifths of the way towards the end of the first movement position. Instead, cadenzas are sort of interspersed.
Well, that would just be missed, yes.
Throughout the whole piece. So it's... The idea of the dramatic alternation between orchestra and soloist, I mean, certainly that's something that Bach and Liszt share, Liszt on a much more flamboyant sort of scale. His first concerto, it starts with the orchestra for about four measures.
That's pretty short by tradition, though.
Yes. It's not a super long concerto, and it has the unusual feature that the movements all sort of meld one into the next. There's no explicit pause between them. They transition one to the other. And there are lots of thematic interrelationships between the movements. I mean, the fourth movement, I guess it introduces one theme of its own, but the rest is all borrowed from the previous movements.
Oh, it ties it together nicely.
Yeah.
Let's see, it's the third movement that I guess in Liszt's day was controversial because of the way it starts.
Oh, as far as the triangle.
Yes.
Yes. It's very distinctive. The third movement is a scherzo, so a lighthearted, upbeat, up-tempo, light movement in 3-4. And it's in a way, it's almost a duet between the piano and the triangle.
It must be one of the most unusual duets out there.
Yes, very much so. I mean, I'm oversimplifying that, but it's very distinctive, the important rhythmic role that the triangle has right from the beginning of the movement, establishing a ding, 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 ding rhythm, which then the woodwinds do something with that and establish a theme, and then I take my turn. The writing for the piano part in there is very twinkly and offsets the triangle.
You use the treble a lot?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. I'm in the top few octaves to a very great extent in that movement.
And I suppose a concerto, let's say we're talking, well, Liszt wrote it over the course of some 20 years or more. But if we're talking the period from 1830 up to, I think it was first performed 1855, this is the piano that is capable of all kinds of things previously unheard of even 20 or 30 years prior.
That's right. I mean, even just in terms of the physical range, the number of notes on the instrument, I mean, it's compared to the Bach keyboard, it's, it extends for one octave further into the bass and one and a half octaves further into the treble. So it goes out to the extremes, and you can make quite a lot of contrasting noise with that range of notes.
What are some of the themes in the Liszt concerto?
Okay, so, I can indicate what the orchestra does at the opening, because this is the central motto of the whole concerto. It's this sort of slightly pompous march-like theme. That's it for the opening orchestra tutti. So in a Mozart concerto, the opening tutti goes for 4 or 5 minutes and introduces lots of different themes. But, of course, Liszt was too much of a virtuoso egoist to allow the orchestra to continue at that much length. So then it's my turn, and I start off essentially with a cadenza, which is a typical gesture. I guess he wasn't the first to do that. I suppose in a way it descends from the Beethoven Emperor Concerto, which in the same key, and also after a very brief single chord in the orchestra part, then has the piano showing off. And so same sort of thing happens here with the pianist launching this way.
Mm-hmm.
So most of that I'm alone, but occasionally the orchestra gives me a little bit of backing up there.
Do you suppose you touch every note on the piano in this concerto?
Pretty much, or all of the notes that Liszt had available. There are now half a dozen more on this keyboard.
Is there anything particularly challenging about this concerto that, as opposed to other concertos or even in Liszt's music in general that you don't find in other works?
Well, it's one interesting thing about it is that the form is a little bit kind of fragmented in a way. There will be themes that sort of flit on stage for a moment, and then he goes on to something else. So it doesn't have sort of a sense of taking a musical idea and sort of working it through thoroughly. Instead, he'll have... he has musical ideas that sort of keep coming back, but he doesn't kind of work at them compositionally in a very
develop them in
comprehensive
great detail.
Way. Uh-huh. Right. So there is a danger, I guess, that it'll come across as a little sort of flitty and fragmentary.
Uh-huh.
So getting sort of a coherent, larger overview of the piece requires a little thought from the performer.
So what kind of cadenza does Liszt give you? Or you say actually the whole concerto is sort of
well,
full
like
of them,
for instance, what I just played uh-huh. is, in fact, that's probably the most extended period that I play alone is right there at the beginning. And then at the beginning of the second movement, I get a fairly long period alone, but that's not really a cadenza. That's me introducing a very beautiful, slow theme.
Do you have a sense of Liszt as an orchestrator?
I think he was... it wasn't sort of his first focus, least in this piece. But he certainly was... he knew how to write for the orchestra, and I think the balances work out very well, and he could be creative and resourceful. The triangle's a good example of that, and he uses trombones at the right moments and so forth, but not in a way that overwhelms the orchestra.
And now back with my guest today, Christopher Taylor, who has so far regaled us with Bach and with Liszt, also recently in your fingertips, a very different kind of music by Béla Bartók.
Right. Yeah, I thought if I wanted to play something complete, I should trot out some solo repertoire since I can only sort of hint at what these concertos are going to be like with the full band. So this is a suite by Bartók written in the 1920s called Out of Doors.
What does that mean, do you suppose, Out of Doors?
Well, it's depicting various sort of pastoral, outdoorsy, countryside kind of subjects.
And we know he got out and about because he collected all those folk songs.
That's right.
His cumbersome
that's
recording
right.
equipment, trekking around Hungary and I guess what's now part of Romania.
Yes. And, of course, what's wonderful about Bartók's style is that he certainly makes reference to these folksy kind of elements, and yet, he incorporated it into a very progressive, I don't know if I'd use the word avant-garde, but a very forward-looking and adventuresome 20th century musical language.
Do they actually have conventional, key signatures, a home key, that kind of thing?
Not really. They're not quite as hardcore atonal as the music that Schoenberg mm-hmm. and Webern were writing at the same period.
Of course, they never liked that term because, of course, there's all kinds of tones in the music.
That's right.
It just doesn't come back to the one you might expect.
Right. A lot of these seem to put particular emphasis, for instance, on the pitch of E, but I wouldn't say that they're an E major per se. And sometimes, he'll use scales that seem vaguely familiar. You know, if they're not major or minor scales, well, maybe they're modes, mm-hmm. or maybe they're pentatonic.
There's a whole bunch of modes, of course, yes. What's the first one called?
Okay, well, their titles are With Drums and Pipes is the first one, and it's very boisterous. And, part of the advantage of writing in this particular harmonic language is that he can use sonorities like, which, you know, are very evocative of bass drums.
And, oh, sure.
And he doesn't have to respect, you know, the key of C major or E major or anything else to achieve effects like that. That gives an idea of sort of the percussive side of his style. And yet, at the same time, it's very tuneful and very pleasant. And then, should I describe the other movements and then play them all? Or?
Oh, why don't we just take them one at a time with a brief setup for each one?
Okay.
So we've heard, it's called Pipes with Pipes and Drums?
Yes, that's right.
You know, if Liszt had lived another 50 years or so, he might have been writing that same kind of thing. It almost seems to take as departure point that kind of dramatic, contrasted writing.
That's right. And Bartok, in his youth, was certainly an admirer of Liszt as a fellow Hungarian and a fellow piano virtuoso. And you can see some of those connections.
And now back with Christopher Taylor and this Suite Out of Doors, is that what it's called?
Correct, yes.
By Béla Bartók from the 1920s. And what's the second one of the five called?
It's the Barcarolle.
So this is probably not going to be quite as percussive as
right,
what we just heard.
Not so brutal, very delicate and lilting kind of rhythms, yet with the meter is constantly shifting. So, you know, one measure will have 6/8 and then the next will have 7 and back and forth. And that's part of what gives it its slightly irregular and yet soothing motion.
Barcarolle.
Thank you.
Well, there was just a little white water there for the boat.
Just a touch.
But I see what you mean about the mode, because, yes, it's not major or minor exactly. There's some interesting things going on there. Mm-hmm. So that was the Barcarolle from the Suite Out of Doors by Bartók. I assume he played these pieces himself. Did he play them in public?
I'm pretty sure, yeah. I mean, certainly he was a formidable pianist and active performer, at least during the stage of his career.
And what's the central piece of this suite?
So it's called musettes, which is another way of saying bagpipes. And it's quite an eccentric movement. I mean, it has that sort of whining kind of combination of droning and whining.
Sounds irresistible.
Yeah, it's very exotic and eccentric, but really interesting and very colorful and effective, I think.
Musette. Is it harder to memorize, what you've done, obviously, a piece like the ones we've heard so far from this collection, if the language is not quite so conventional, so traditional, so you might even say idiomatic as what we would be used to?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a bit of a different skill, learning to recognize and reconstruct on the fly all of these exotic harmonies. And yet, you know, with practice, they start to feel familiar, and you start to get to know them on their own terms, and you know, you start recognizing, oh, here's the whole tone scale, and here's the chord that looks a little bit like a G9 chord or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I can see that. And then there are little, I suppose you could call motifs or at least phrases that recur.
That's right. That's right. I mean, sometimes that's helpful and sometimes that's confusing because they may...
Where am I?
They may recur 10 times each time, a little bit different. And this next one, the Knight's Music, is fantastically evocative sort of piano writing. But it's a real pain in the neck to memorize just because there's these four or five different cells of musical material and they keep flitting in and out, coming back and in slightly unpredictable orders. And so you just have to sort of brute memorize a bunch of facts about what the sequence of events is.
The Knight's Music?
The Knight's Music.
A knight with an N?
With an N, not with a K, no. It's insects and bullfrogs.
Oh.
And then at some point, there's some sort of shepherd's tune coming from the distance or something like that. But it's, for the most part, it's just rustling noises. It's really neat.
Knight's Music. certainly evocative. Night's music. So, that's the fourth of the five, and we won't have actually time to hear it. But what's the final one of that set?
Right,
Sweet Outdoors?
As usual, I've allocated more than I can fit in the hour. My students can tell you all about that.
Keep us in suspense.
But anyway, the last one is called The Chase, and it's really a barn burner, so I'm sorry I don't have time to do it.
We'll burn the barn next time.
Okay, sounds good.
I look forward to that. Are you going to be playing these pieces, or how did you find them?
Well, I played them last month, actually, out in California, and I first learned them back in college, so off and on, they've been important pieces to me through my life.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing The Chase. That's also also in the kind of the tradition of Liszt, because he had these hunt and chase pieces.
Oh, yes.
So, well, you've got me in suspense. Well, maybe we could... I tell you what, we'll see if we can put that on our website if you want to play it after 1 o'clock.
Sure.
How does that sound?
I'll do
you can find it at WPR.org/midday. That'll be a fun way to approach that. And so quite a contrast, I would say, that you provided us today with the Bach keyboard concerto, we'll call it, and then the Liszt Piano Concerto No. 1, a real showpiece by contrast, and then just now these... very atmospheric, sort of off-kilter pieces by Bartok.
Yeah.
Sweet Out of Doors. Always a pleasure having you here.
Thank you.
Christopher Taylor.